You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Due to a little bit of a technical difficulty this morning, the very, very front part of this interview was clipped off. So, with apologies, here's Ken Rogers for about an hour plus talking about Ken Burns and his thoughts on the documentary as a fellow documentary maker. Ken Rogers is a former corporal, United States Marine Corps. He's a veteran of the siege at Khe Sanh as a member of Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26 Marines, and just an awesome guy. So without any further ado, here's the interview that got a little bit screwed up this morning. How emotional it was for their family and just all those different layers of the story that are pretty absolutely amazing. How tough is it, do you think it is to do that with people you don't know?
Well, I think it is tough, even with people that you do know, to get them to talk about it. And you know, I think if you're a really good interviewer and you don't go in and you're not, you know, like so many people in you see these interviewers in new situations where they're so aggressive. If you're not aggressive with them and you allow them to talk and you create a familiarity and then you just let them talk. And I think if you let them talk, the stories will come out. And if they feel familiar with you, you know, and I mean, these guys have done a lot of this stuff. I mean, they're very experienced filmmakers. I don't know if they, you know, they may have had a veteran there sitting with those people or somebody that went through it, may have been involved in part of it.
Interesting. My guest this morning, Ken Rogers. Here's another email. Mac, in terms of the significance of the way Khe Sanh was treated in the documentary, Ken's thoughts on that?
Well, you know, they covered it to some extent. They did say, you know, they had the North Vietnamese officer on there, so right. It was a diversion.
Right.
I personally don't think that's true, but, you know, he may have been in a position to know more about that than I do. If it was a diversion, it was one that cost him a lot of people.
You know what, Ken, I had the exact same reaction when if you're willing to commit that to the diversion, that's a hell of a diversion.
Yeah, it's a hell of a diversion. And, you know, they were intent on overrunning Khe Sanh. You know, they had leaflets that they were going to distribute basically telling us how to behave. And, you have interviewed a guy by the name of Mike Archer.
Yes.
Who was in a position to be a lot more in on the know of what was going on strategically out there in the field. And a number of times they were massed to try to overrun us and they just couldn't pull the trigger. I mean, they just couldn't do it. And if they had tried, I think they would have probably, you know, I'd be the POW or a dead man. So, they just couldn't get it done because we had sensors out there that when they massed, we knew it. So then it was like, you know, you get all of these B-52s show up and artillery and 175s from the rock pile and or Camp Carroll or wherever they were down there.
Right,
and,
but that was your – it was like, please mass to try to do something, right? Please.
Yeah, that was the goal.
Right. So. Yeah. No, I mean, that's the way – in fact, it's amazing now. In the few experiences in my life and on three separate deployments, almost 3 years of doing that, stuff in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, they never massed. And I want to say maybe only two or three occasions. And people were giddy with excitement that we're going to finally be able to get it on with these guys. You know, we're not going to have to chase them and they're not going to run away. We're going to be able to get it on. This is going to be awesome. And so it really, it was really an interesting, I remember, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't us, but it was RCT2 north of us in Afghanistan. and these guys were standing and fighting, and they were they attempted a counterattack. And I remember watching it in a chat window, the tactical reporting, and we were just mesmerized. And people were saying, "What's going on?" It's like the Taliban up there and Sangin, they're going to counterattack. They've got a recoilless rifle. And people were like, "What? Yeah, check it out. Watch this." And we were watching the tactical reporting in the feed. They were like, "Oh my God, I would so love to be there." You know, and it was against 1st Recon Battalion, and 1st Recon Battalion annihilated them. They killed almost 200 guys, and they had two guys wounded. Mm. It was amazing. And because if you mass against the United States, you just did us a favor. Because we will see it.
Oh yeah,
we will see it. And even in Vietnam, with early technology, with sensors and things like that, they could still do it. And so I thought that was that raised my eyebrow when he talked about Khe Sanh as a diversion. I was like, well,
yeah.
Here's another.
Well, of course, you know, anybody who was there didn't like that. It was like it wasn't a diversion if you were there. I guarantee you.
That thought went through my head. I thought there's some people that just spit out whatever they're drinking around the country who were involved at Khe Sanh. Here's another interesting email. Mac, one of the things that I took away was the different perspective of the North Vietnamese government. They had no regard for the casualties that they suffered. It was part of their struggle, and they did not look at it as a short-term event, that ultimately they would prevail if they just stuck to it. Do you think that the United States ever understood that? Ken, do you think that the United States ever understood how resolute they were to become?
No. You know, the only person that I have ever encountered in a position of authority that I think that had an inkling of that was George Ball. You know who he was?
Yeah, I do. I do know who George Ball was. He was if you followed, you know, the Vietnam War and the State Department and the DOD during what the 60s and the 70s, you knew that name.
Yes, he actually gamed out, I think, in 1964, what was going to happen. And, you know, basically he submitted it to McNamara and his group of statisticians and
idiots.
You know,
no relation. Just everybody knows, no relation.
Yeah, you know, the mathematics of war.
Yeah, there you go. Hey.
You know.
But you know what?
Yeah.
We did it again in Iraq. We had the same arrogant idiot in Rumsfeld. McNamara reincarnated as Rumsfeld, and he ripped up the war plan. And now you watch the testimony of General Shinseki saying, yeah, you're going to need, you know, probably several hundred thousand, because you're going to take the clamps off these three groups in Iraq. And if there's nothing there to enforce the laws and punish crime and keep order, what you'll have shortly is a civil war. And Rumsfeld shows him the door, tears up the war plan, and just does it himself. And
right.
Pathetic. Absolutely pathetic.
So anyway, George Ball, you know, he gamed it out and said, this is what's going to happen. And pretty much what happened is what he said. And of course, they buried his report because it didn't fit McNamara and LBJ's vision of what they wanted to happen.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think, you know, I don't think that people like Westmoreland and the generals of the Marine Corps that were fighting the war, I don't think that they were thinking about that. I think they were trying to figure out how to win it, given the constraints they were under.
They're
just trying to do their jobs.
As you watch another part of the thing of the documentary that I thought was fascinating was simply life on the Ho Chi Minh Trail and the logistic effort to I'm curious about your thoughts on that as you watch that.
Well, I just thought about how, you know, and of course we kind of knew what was going on, that they were moving gear, they were moving equipment, all through the summer of 67. For a number of months in 67, Bravo Company was out on those hills west of Quezon, and you could, from Hill 881 south, you could look over across the next ridge line into Laos, and we were bombing the hell out of that thing then, and we knew that they were moving trucks, they were moving troops, they were moving equipment. I didn't know how primitive it was there. That's one of the things I learned from the movie, was what a primitive operation they had. But it was successful. And listening to that woman talk about working on it, and she went as a young girl,
right,
and she worked on that thing, and I thought how terrifying it must have been there when they, you know, when those B-52 raids came in. Man, they dropped a lot of crap, man.
What's the closest that you ever had B-52s dropping to you?
Well, they came right outside of the perimeter at Quezon. We all had to get in our holes. They were a couple hundred yards out.
So what's that like? Would that much ordnance falling that close?
You know, I be honest with you, I really don't remember that much about it. I remember us getting in our holes. And by the time they were doing that, they started doing that, I think, in early March of 68. We'd been at it for a month and a half, and it was just like nothing surprised me. I mean, nothing was a shock to me. Nothing was, you know, it was like nothing was impressive.
And how many days would that have been into it?
Mm-hmm. 40, 45, 45, 45, 50 days into it. And they, you know, they said, we're going to have a big arc light, and that's what we called them, you know,
right,
arc light raids.
Right.
And everybody getting their holes. So we did, and I can remember the ground shaking, and but I wasn't impressed.
I was impressed. That is the lasting impression. I was impressed. Ken Rogers, our guest here, he a documentary filmmaker. We're talking about Ken Burns' PBS documentary, The Vietnam War. Here's another email. Well, hold on. Before I get to this email, I, too, was struck by the low-technology solutions that the North Vietnamese, more people, wooden shovels, they've got, you know, they've got baskets on sticks, and that's how they're moving dirt, and we're blowing gigantic holes in that work on a daily basis, and they just keep repairing it, like ants, they just keep repairing it, they go back and repair it, thousands of them, on a daily basis to get it up and running, move trucks, and you're watching that black and white footage of those trucks bouncing down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and you're just sitting there shaking your head going, you've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me. And then how you can fight a war and not get after your opponent's logistics. And we're doing similar stuff by allowing, you know, the Taliban to be able to move back and forth between Afghanistan and Pakistan, Pakistan giving them sanctuary. And if that's going on, there's no end to the conflict in sight. There's no end. They can go be safe. But the low technology on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, I thought was, again, along with the North Vietnamese perspective, the Viet Cong perspective, I thought that was awesome to be able to watch and hear those interviews.
Yeah, that was really to me one of the highlights of the film, I think, or the series. It was, you know, seeing how it was. I mean, and it was tough. I mean, it was, even if nobody had ever been shooting at you, all that physical labor, you know, I mean, carrying all that stuff, they were carrying it, they were building roads, and then you got somebody trying to kill you 24 hours a day. So, very impressive. And, you know, if you think about the determination that part of the story tells you about those people. And then you kind of get an idea of why we just couldn't kick the shit out of them.
Yeah. The
they were a hell of a lot more determined than we were as a society.
God, you know what just flashed through my head was one of the things that I've learned that Vietnam veterans live with is they came home and they went to VFWs and Legion halls and got their asses chewed by World War II guys. Like, you know, shit like, what the hell is wrong with you guys? You can't kick their ass? And then you watch the documentary and you look at them and you're like, yeah, you know, show some respect, okay? They're good fighters, and they would come and they would die. I remember, and I just heard it last weekend about coming home. I'll tell you a real quick story. I was a guest speaker a week ago, Friday night, at the birthday ball for a Osprey squadron, VMM 164, which is the modern day version of HMM 164 that may have flown you around Vietnam. They're an old CH-46 squadron and got their were originally stood up in 1964, and then every major battle, you know, Hue, Khe Sanh, they supported. So as I got up to speak, I always ask, are there any Vietnam veterans here? Guy puts his hand up in the back, and I ask him to stand up, and I said, and I thanked him. And as I thanked him, the whole room stood up. This squadron's a good squadron. You can tell by being around them. They all stood up and they gave the guy a standing ovation. He comes up to me afterwards, Ken, and he puts this like meat hook clamp on my arm, and he says, "Tonight's one of the greatest nights of my life. Thank you." And I said, "Thank me? Like, what are you talking about? Thank you?" He said, "No, you don't understand." And he told me, he said, "You know, not only was it just coming home, but, you know, World War II veterans treated us like crap." You know?
That's right.
And I heard that, and I was like, God almighty, man. Did you guys ever catch a break? And the answer to that is no, right?
Right.
Amazing.
Nobody talked about it.
Yeah.
Safest thing to do is keep your mouth shut. So.
Well, so that was the safest thing to do, right? So,
yeah.
Wow. In fact, this comment came up the other day. Vietnam vets that are still in therapy after all these years, why are they still in therapy? And I answered it. I said, they've never dealt with it. They came home. Nobody wanted to deal with them. And so they stuffed it away. And now they're retired. And that stuff is seeping back out. I mean, it's like it's never really gone away, but they faked it. And so what are they dealing with? They're dealing with the same thing that Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, guys are dealing with because they've never dealt with it. And you see this. Wow. I didn't know that. And it is pretty amazing. Here's another email. Mac, if there was one major thing that Ken didn't see in there that wanted to see in there, what would that be?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure I can answer that because I thought they were pretty comprehensive in their coverage of it. I've been thinking about it a lot since I watched it, and, you know, I don't think that they – all of the American warriors that they discussed the war with and that they put on – into the films, I thought the narrative was pretty consistently talking about how we kept getting our butts kicked, I guess is how I put it. And I don't think it was always like that. I think if you were at Khon Tien, it was like that. If you were at Khe Sanh, like that. If you were at Hamburger Hill, it was like that. But I think there were instances where Americans actually fought these guys, and it wasn't as dire and as dour as they made it sound.
You know,
so I wondered if they should have had a couple of guys in there talking about that.
Barney Barnum was on a couple weeks, Medal of Honor recipient from Vietnam, and he echoed the same sentiment. He said, I watched the first two episodes, I was busy, and then I had guys emailing, and they were getting angry, so I didn't watch any more of it. He said, but from what I've heard, the one perspective that's missing is, and he said, hey, we didn't lose any battles over there. He said, look, we may have taken our lumps, but at the end of the day, we owned whatever it was, and they didn't, and they left. And not only did they leave, they ran away. He said, so look, he said, they're good fighters, but they were no match for us. You know, he fought in I Corps, and he said, you talk to Marines who fought, and we have tremendous respect for the North Vietnamese soldiers. He said, but we kicked their ass. He said, if you look at the numbers in Tet, they were bled white. The Viet Cong, the NVA, all of it, you know. So really, a tactical victory in Vietnam, you know, where we own the battlefield at the end of the day, and then we quit. And he said, from what I heard, there wasn't ramrod guys talking in there. And so,
right.
So I want to go back and watch it a second time and see if it's as missing as he said it was. Because he didn't watch it. I wish he would have watched it so he could have given a more complete opinion about it. But what is give me feedback from your friends, Ken. Is there mixed opinions about
yeah.
it?
Yeah, there's mixed opinions. You know, there's a lot of guys, and I think this is probably consistent. You'd find this consistent with the men you served with in combat, who went over to Vietnam, and they did their job, and they did a good job under extremely difficult circumstances, and they thought they were doing something that was good for the world.
Right.
And they feel like that doesn't get said.
Well, you know, and again, I think he tried to at some points do it, because the domino theory, if you were watching this, you know, VE Day, World War II, VJ Day in World War II. Then what happens? You know, the Soviet Union, you know, starts building walls. And all these countries that were, quote-unquote, liberated are now under, you know, communist rule. Right? And then China.
Right.
You know, Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong dueling over what China would become. And, you know, we obviously, you know, friends with Chiang Kai-shek, and Mao wins, and Chiang Kai-shek goes to Taiwan, and boom, another part of the map turns red, right? And then we do Korea, right? And we fight to a stalemate there. And now, you know, now we have communist encroachment again, you know, coming. So the domino theory was real for a lot of Americans. Now, in retrospect, we could say, oh, you know, well, where else was it going? Wasn't going anywhere else. Well, you know, that wasn't. It's like judging history through your contemporary lens. That's not.
And you can't do that.
And you can't do that.
I mean,
and you can't do that. So when you look at it, what you had was you had the grandsons of World War I guys, the sons of World War II guys that were going to do their part for their country, and this red menace that you know, through the Cuban Missile Crisis we had seen, and these dominoes falling, was real. It was real, no shit, real. And I agree. I don't know that that's covered enough. That's given, because I think a lot of times you when you hear it discussed, it's almost like, well, it was ridiculous, but here's what they said.
Well, it wasn't ridiculous. I mean, it was real, and that's exactly what it was. And they, you know, and it went on after Vietnam. I mean, it was going on in Mozambique and in Angola and a lot of places around the world. And, you know, the Cubans were in all of those countries. And so, I mean, it was like there was a worldwide global conflict going on.
Nicaragua,
often,
right? Nicaragua with Daniel
Ortega?
Yeah,
often with, you know, proxy war armies, but it was still going on.
Right.
I mean, it was real. I mean, the Soviets were out doing their thing, and if anybody thinks that they weren't, you know, you didn't live in that time. So, and, you know, these guys, I think the guys, a lot of guys that I've talked to, I haven't talked to a lot of people at length about it except one or two people who actually agreed with me and thought the film was well done, but there were a lot of guys that I respect and think a lot of who basically don't like the way the story was told because it doesn't tell their story.
Right.
And their story was, my country needed me. I went and fought the war. I was among a bunch of valiant men. We kicked their butts every time we met them. And it's not our fault we lost the government, you know, the United States government. It's politics by other means is what war is.
Right.
Our government decided it wasn't important enough to close it out. And they feel that that story didn't get told. So,
you know, one of the things that Barney Barnum told me was, look, if you can do that, and you don't include what John Ripley did at the bridge at Dong Ha, then you didn't even cover it. So I think from a military military guy's perspective, there's certain things that they expect to see in there, but it wasn't, you know, it's like, yeah, but it's not a military chronology of the war. It's not just about the fight. You know what I think? What makes it worth watching is all the different perspectives, all the different layers that went into this event, this historical event, and it was a lot more than simply just the fighting. I don't mean to say that in any kind of disrespectful or condescending way, but there's certainly the fight is at the center of this, but the politics behind it, the coups behind it, you know, the protests in the United States, you know, all of, you know, the turmoil in the United States, all that is a part of, quote unquote, Vietnam. You know,
it's part of the story. The story is, and I think that I agree with you. That's what makes it, for me, that's what made it work.
Right.
The scope of the story.
Yeah. And I would even say it has its flaws, but I would tell you if only to get the Vietnamese perspective and to understand it, it's worth watching for that alone, with all of its flaws. So it's interesting. Let me read you one more email, Ken. And Ken Rogers, our guest. Did you get out as a Lance Corporal? What rank did you? What was the highest rank you attained in the Marine Corps?
I was a corporal.
When you got out?
Yeah. Okay. I was in 3 years and 29 days. I was a corporal. Right before I left Vietnam, my platoon commander came up and I was a Lance Corporal and he said, Rogers, I could make you a corporal, but I don't think you want that rank. And I remember standing there looking at him and I did not respond to him. I didn't tell him, yeah, I want to be a corporal. By that time, I kind of come to the conclusion that, I really didn't care much about any of it. The thing that I really loved about the Ken Burns piece is an individual that they interviewed in there was an Army officer, an American Army officer, I believe was either Japanese or Chinese heritage. Remember that guy?
No.
Oh man! Well, he was on there. You know, he talked quite a bit, and he talked about what it was like going on some of those hills down there in the Central Highlands. And I really liked that guy. I thought he was an outstanding subject for an interview. Just so brutally honest about what it was like.
You know, I thought most of the people that were brutally honest with it. Here's another email. Mac, what about the anti-war stuff? Was that overplayed? Was it done in the appropriate context? I'm curious what Ken's thoughts are about that. Rogers, to you.
Well, I thought it was fairly accurate myself in terms of, you know, that aspect of the story in context of the bigger narrative. I never paid much attention to any of that. I never got spit on. I never got called a baby killer, so I didn't have those experiences. Most of the time, people just kind of ignored me. But I know, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s, the violence and uproar of the anti-war movement was huge. I mean, it was huge.
Right.
And so I don't think they overdid it.
Were you offended at all? If anybody had not seen John Kerry's speech to what it, was that the Senate Foreign was that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee?
Right.
If anybody had not seen that, and I know a couple of people that hadn't, who you know, when I spoke with them, they were like, "Holy smokes, man! I'm not the biggest John Kerry fan." And there was stuff that he said there that was absolutely not true. But at a relatively young age, you could see that he was somebody, you know, destined for good things possibly, because he was well-spoken, well-thought, extremely articulate, and, you know, and what he said spoke for a lot of people, even given the flaws in what he said.
I remember all of that. I've never forgotten it, and he pissed me off, man, because I thought he portrayed, I thought a lot of his comments added to the misconception of the Vietnam veteran, personally. I mean, it did. I remember it well. He pissed me off.
Well, you know what, and I, you know, it's interesting. I have a next-door neighbor who was an A-4 pilot in Vietnam, and, you know, and one of the things he goes, did you see John Kerry's? And I said, yeah. He goes, man, I love that guy. So it's really interesting, Vietnam veterans even. And I know, but
oh, yeah.
The majority
yeah.
of the sentiment, and so Vietnam veterans are split. There's a few lightning rod figures. Kerry's one of them. That speech is one of them. Because a lot of what, I won't say a lot, but the atrocity stuff he says in that, from what I've read and my ability to footnote, grossly exaggerated.
Right.
A lot of the other stuff he said in there was absolutely spot on. The atrocity stuff to me was overstated. Interesting.
And that's what pissed me off, because I thought, you know, there was a, you know, I don't know if you remember back then, but, you know, this notion that we were all just a bunch of crazy Vietnam vets, and then, you know, you better look out or we're going to shoot you or go crazy on the street and do something weird, and I just thought he added to that conception.
Well, he sure as hell did. And, you know, again, my recollection being, I would have been in 1968, I would have been 11 years old. But when you saw somebody with a fatigue jacket on and some blue jeans, you know, you'd kind of look like, is that guy a veteran? And then,
yep, that's right.
And depending on what he wore on his field jacket, because a lot of people wore them because they thought they were cool. But guys who had them for real, they had different things on their jackets, and you could tell that they were real veterans. And but that was part of the whole Vietnam thing. The here's another email, Mac. I know you've said it before, but I'm sitting at work today. Could Ken talk about where we can get his documentary? I would love to hear the part where they talk about being on that OP. Rogers, tell everybody where they get your DVD.
www.bravotheproject.com. And they can go in there, and that's basically a blog site with a bunch of tabs at the top where you can go meet who's in the movie. And if you're interested in procuring a copy of it, you can go to buy the DVD. So.
And let me tell you, I would wholeheartedly recommend it to you. Both my sons have watched it, and they both had similar reactions to it, which is holy, and I won't say the last word because I'm being polite today, and it's right before Thanksgiving. But it's intense, and Ken gave me some advice. He said, watch it with a good sound system. So let me ask you about that. Did you specifically design it to be unnerving?
Yes. We had some great help from the guy that edited it. His name's John Nutt. He's a Vietnam vet, by the way, who's worked for like 40 years for Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas. And he did both the film and sound editing. And when, you know, I always thought an editor was most basically film editing, but sound is, especially in American film, is an extremely important part of what you see in the end product or hear or experience. So when we were working with him early on, we had, you know, basically designated the interviews for use in the film. And we had been at his house, which is in the San Francisco area, watching it on his system. And when Betty and I left, we said to him, John, you're a sound guy, because that's where most of his work on, you know, like Amadeus and Apocalypse Now and stuff like that. He was in the sound department. I says, you're a sound guy. I says, why don't you, you know, get creative with that? And his eyes lit up. So we consciously wanted to use the sound of war as a tool to make the film more intense.
Do you want an impression?
Yeah.
After I had watched probably about 30 minutes of it, it was pissing me off with the realization that these guys did this for 77 days. I just did 30 minutes and I'm ready to like shut the shit off. My dog's under the bed. Jack's in the other room under the bed. And there's, you know, the in and out of the scenes, this audio sound is just, and if you have a good sound system, I mean, it comes through. If you have surround sound, if you have a subwoofer, right, the incoming
right.
is, and then I'm thinking that bastard Rogers, he told me, before I watched it, he sent me an email. He said, make sure you watch it on a good sound system and turn it up loud.
Right.
And you begin to think, these guys did this for 77 days. No wonder they're not right in the head.
That's right. That's exactly right. And you know, I mean, it's adds a dimension to the film that makes it more real. It makes it real in some regard. I mean, it's not, you know, you're not hearing somebody talk. You're actually feeling down inside your corpuscles some of the impact of what it was like to be there. I mean, we were trying to make it an experience. And so he certainly knew a hell of a lot more about it than I did, but he took our urging and he used sound to great effect, I thought.
Do you care?
Matter of fact, when he sent us the first the first cut, he was doing that, and I was saying, you can't do that. I said to myself, he can't do that.
Really?
It was just so, wow. Over, you know, it was like so powerful.
No,
I said, he can't do that. And then I thought about it, and I said, hell yeah.
The audio is powerful, especially if those noises are part of your life. So if you've been in a fight, I mean, even in training, if they've been part of your life, you know, the sounds of artillery, guns. Do you care if I play the opening scene? Just the audio?
Go ahead.
All right, here it is. You'll hear the natural. You can hear the natural noise.
People don't understand how dark is like there, because there's just absence of light. So when it's black there, it is black. So I was on this listening post, and I told the other three guys that were there to go ahead and go to sleep, that I would man the radio and stay on watch, you know, because everybody was just beat to death and tired. I was laying on the ground with my head on the radio and the microphone on my chest. And every 15 minutes, they would call the LP and say, are you all secure? And we would just click the bike, and that would be response, that we were okay. And I remember they had called and asked if everything was secure, and I did that. And as it would have it, when I heard somebody coming towards me, they were really quiet, up to the point they were just 10 feet in front of me. And I was laying on the edge of the trail in the grass with the radio. I was using it as a pillow, basically. And then all of a sudden, I saw this, you know, NVA patrol came out of nowhere. He stepped out on the silhouette of the skyline, like I say, and all of a sudden I saw his head and shoulders, and he was coming towards me. And it was just total panic, you know, as far as, like, what do you do? And he walked up almost to my feet and stopped. And I thought for sure he was looking at me, you know. And I was just laying motionless because I didn't know if I had time, but my rifle was laying on the side of me here. I didn't have it in my hand. A lot of things go through your mind, you know. And I didn't know whether to try to grab this rifle or to lay and see what happened. And as it turned out, he stopped. And then there was like more came up behind him. And they were speaking in Vietnamese, of course. And they were talking. And, of course, at the time, I'm thinking, he's saying, hey, there's a guy laying right here at my feet, you know. And I remember reaching for the rifle, and I was bringing it very slowly up, and I was trying to get to the trigger to take the safety off. And just as I got it in my hand and started bringing it up, he started walking, and he stepped on the side of my arm. And he just kept walking like it was nothing. So I remember there was six or seven of them, and they all walked right past, and I would just remember praying, you know, it's like, God, don't make a sound. And they moved on by, and as soon as they got past, you know, 20 feet, I figured it's time to go. And that was, like, basically for me, that was the start of the siege.
So that's the start of Ken's documentary. Ken, that is awesome. I mean, that audio is – and what's that guy's name?
Steve Weiss.
Steve Weiss.
W-I-E-S-E. He was in – he spent 18 months with Bravo Company. He did a 12-month tour. And then he – back in the day, you could extend for 6 months, and he'd send you home for 30 days. And then you'd come back, and he came back, and right after he came back, the siege started.
That'll teach you, right? What do they tell you? Yeah. Never volunteer, okay? Never,
yeah.
No matter what, don't volunteer. No, but just the power of that scene, and then the audio, you know, of the artillery after he says, and for me, that's the start of the siege, and then you hear boom. It's just the power of the documentary, especially war documentaries that are well done to me is pretty incredible. And again, I'm not selling for Ken. I'm just telling you, if you're interested in post-combat related mental health, if you're interested in Marine Corps history, if you're interested at how guys behave in combat, Ken's documentary is something that you need to watch, because again, it's just so well done by somebody who fought, who was there, who knows the story that ought to be told. And then, but like I said, the sound, you know, after a while, you're like one of the, and again, I don't know when I felt it, but, because, you know, again, in 2004, you know, we got rocketed and mortared a lot in Iraq. And you hear those sounds and they piss you off. And I remember coming home and my sons had I think they call them endo boards, where there's a cylinder and there's a board that goes on top of it and they try to balance on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were they had it upstairs and their bedroom was just above the TV room. And when they would jump off the endo board, you'd get this vibration and this boom. And right. I remember I was watching TV and I started getting irritated and I could feel, I don't know if you call it anxiety or just adrenaline. And I finally went upstairs and I said, "Hey, could you guys stop doing that?" And they said, "Is it too loud?" And I said, "No, it's the boom and the vibration. It's starting to make me a little bit anxious." And they looked at me, they're like, "Okay."
What's the matter with him?
Whoops, okay. But yeah. but you know, when you and I felt I had the same experience, you know, with the sound effects associated with your documentary. And then I thought, you know, that son of a bitch Rogers, he did this to me on purpose because he's trying to communicate. That's what they lived through for 77 days. And nice. Which even further makes what you guys did even more amazing and further evidence why you're not right in the head. So, but we love having you around. Let me one more email, Ken, and then I'll let you go. I appreciate your time this morning.
Yes.
Mac, I'm curious from Ken's perspective, the art of the documentary is certainly something unique relative to filmmaking. For those of us who do enjoy the craft, and for those of us who prefer that genre, is there anything he would tell us about good documentaries and how they're made and what they ought to see? Interesting kind of question. An art question for you there, Corporal.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think the most important thing about film, basically, and it certainly holds for documentary, is that you have to have a really good story. The most important thing you can have, in my mind, is a story that is compelling, that hooks people, that will keep them watching it until a resolution has been made. It doesn't have to be good. It could be good, bad, indifferent, but some kind of epiphanic moment in the film that teaches us something. And you can have all of the fancy technical stuff, you can have sound, you can have, you know, great people talking, but if you don't have a story underlying it, it just doesn't work. And I watch so many documentary films that would be so much better if they just had told a story, if they had a better, stronger story. So that, you know, that's what I think.
The story. You got to tell the story.
Well, and you got to have a story. You got to have a story. You got to have a story that hooks people in the beginning and keeps them hooked. And then when you get to the back end, there needs to be some kind of message that they can take away from what they've watched. That's what I think.
All right. Well, what's the message of Quezon?
Pardon?
What's the message of Quezon?
What is the message? Well, I think our film has a number of messages. One of them is this is what it's like when you send people to war. But it also is like talks about, like you said, you know, there's issues in there about post-combat mental health. There's messages about that. There's messages about politics and the history of warfare. And so, not which I intended to have anything to do with in the film particularly, but they just came out once these guys started talking. So.
Yeah, who's the guy who talks about the fight in the trench line after towards the end of the siege and you guys go back out? Who's that guy? What's that guy's name?
The guy with the bald head.
Yeah, who's
his name's Michael O'Hara.
I think he gives a narrative of going into this trench line. And the fight in this trench line, and you're watching him, and he is so animated, and I don't mean like a talent.
Oh, well, we're talking, no, we're, that's Frank McCauley is who you're talking.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah.
Yeah, Frank McCauley, yeah, he was there, man.
When you watch him, and you see how animated, and I don't mean animated in an Italian way, I mean how intense as he's describing this thing. You're watching him, and he's in that trench when he's doing it, and you're thinking, after all these years, after almost 50 years, that experience is that vivid in his head. So what does that tell what does that tell the rest of us about it ain't going away, and you ain't getting over it, so you better learn to surf. You better learn to surf, and you better learn to live with it, because it ain't going away.
We're not hearing that, dude.
No, but I'll tell you what, it is probably one of the most intense parts of the documentary is Frank McCauley. I want to say it about two-thirds of the way through, recounting the killing that they did. Towards the end of the siege, they went outside and they caught, you know, some of the NVA, and they hammered the shit out of them. And him telling that story about just the almost like microsecond in high definition, the thoughts that are going through his head and then what they're doing. It's good. It's awesome. But and Ken, there's no way you can't prepare for that, right? I'm sure you're sitting there with your not with your jaw on the ground, but thinking, oh my God, this is so powerful. This is so powerful. And so, what were your thoughts when you were watching him do that for the first time?
Well, I was, you know, it was like I had met Frank once. A couple of years before, he's kind of a, not so much now, but back then he was ebullient, in a Vietnam vet sort of way. And so my experience with him had been like for maybe 20 minutes of him being kind of like he was on screen. But I was still, he floored me that he would be he was not talking to me. He was engrossed in those moments. And it just went on and on and on. Cause, you know, I transcribed all of these interviews and that, those are just little segments of a much longer cut that he just talked. And I never interrupted him. He just talked and talked and talked and talked and talked about that day, which it's about 5 hours. And,
wow.
His face, just watching his face, and how he was not talking to me. He was back in that moment and he was articulating exactly what was happening in his head, in his memory.
It's
so visceral.
It's incredibly, and you can tell of all, you know, for instance, we're talking about the Ken Burns' thing, and we're talking about Ken Rogers' documentary. And one of the things that the most vivid thing that I recall from the documentary is the sound, my dog being under the bed, its effect on me, and this particular interview that even in the midst of you know, dozens of powerful moments where these guys are talking about my leg getting blown off, you know, the Ghost Patrol, all these just incredibly powerful moments in Ken's documentary. This guy all of a sudden comes bombing on your screen and you watch him and you just think, oh, holy shit, man. Holy shit. He is in the, and again, it's in high definition as he's telling you with the narrative of his brain going on, what his brain was telling him, hey, that guy doesn't see me. Boom, I'll kill him. And he goes through this, and then, boom, and it's so, wow. And that just,
yeah.
And then as a documentary filmmaker, that just falls into your lap and you're like, wow. What do I?
Yeah.
How did you, for instance, hey, when are you going to do the director's cut and make this thing about 3 hours? Come on, man, you're not doing anything now. Why don't you get your ass to work, Rogers. Come on. I want to see the, if you have that, how much total time do you have in terms of interviews with Quezon guys?
Well, I got about 22 hours, but I have 6 hours of what you saw in that movie. I have 6 hours of that stuff.
You got to do the director's cut, bro. Come on. Don't be screwing us over. We're not the typical audience, okay?
I understand. You are jarheads.
Exactly. So, we're jugheads.
Yeah. So, you know, it's the first cut I watched was 6 hours long. And it was just a lot of great stuff got left out. I mean, a lot of great, you know, great stuff got left out. But, you know, it's almost too long as it is for general public consumption. So.
Okay. That's my point. We're not talking general public consumption. We're talking about the jughead population. I think you should do the director's cut, make it 6 hours, and, you know, kind of do it like the phase one, phase two, part one, part two, and part three. And that way people can digest it. You can come on and talk. You can narrate a lot of it. Hi, this is Ken. This is my wife, Betty. This is my dog, Elliot. And I just have some thoughts I want to share with you. And you could kind of weave your and you're like, see this guy? I didn't really like this guy. I always thought he was a douchebag, but turns out he's not. So listen to him. You can like weave that kind of stuff, a little personality, and then that way you'll glue it all together. But I think I would love to see all 6 hours because that stuff is you know. I don't even know.
It's revelatory about what humans are capable of doing. So, you know, I mean,
the other story that I tell all the time. Well, I won't say all the time, but when I have this thing about institutional discipline and you know, for instance, the urination stuff is back in the news for the Marine Corps because a staff sergeant was found, the charges were his conviction was overturned because they found that General Amos had used undue command influence, and then they didn't reveal that to the defense attorneys, blah 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 blah. Anyway, so when I talk about these episodes when we have of moral failure, you know, one of the things I cite is a story that you told me when I asked you about mutilations and killing civilians. Was that part of your experience? Well, I brought you back on to talk about My Lai, and I was actually shocked that you said, yeah, I'll come on and talk about that. And I was shocked that everybody I asked said the same thing. They wanted to talk about it because My Lai had burned in their ass for a long time, and they certainly had things to say about it. But you told me a story about being out on the patrol at the end of kind of the siege, and you were looking for the NVA, and that you had moved through an area, and there was essentially decomposed bodies, and one of the Marines picked up a bone. I think you said a leg bone, and stuck it in his war belt. And within a few minutes' time, one of the NCOs walked up and said, "Get rid of that shit right now." And that's the rudder steer that you need from leaders in combat that keeps, you know, young men who have to do that work, you know, pointed in the right direction and not going down a road that I think tempts a fair amount of people. But you have to have those that steady hand on your shoulder when you begin to buckle and want to go the wrong way, because you have to live with that. And here's what I say, Ken. The Commandant has this saying, keep your honor clean. Why do you keep your honor clean? You have to live with it. You have to live with it forever. And all you have to do is watch videos of guys who were at My Lai and see what their life turned into and how that event ruined so many lives, because they had to live with that for the rest of their life. And so, you know, keep your honor clean sounds like something that you want to do for the Marine Corps. It ain't. And the Marine Corps is selling it wrong. You keep your honor clean because every night when you put your head on that pillow, you're going to go to dreamland. And if your honor isn't clean, trust me, eternity is a long time to live with that shit. So I cite you all the time.
Let me correct one thing.
Go ahead.
It was not at the end of the siege. That actually happened right after the hill fights. And so this would have been like in late May, early June of 67. We were on Hill 881 was our base camp. Hill 881 South, and we were up on Hill 881 North, where they had a hell of a battle up there earlier in May. So that was like early on in my tour, actually. So.
All right, I'll correct that.
Okay, but he did get his ass shaped up real quick.
Well, so. And you know what? And God bless whoever the NCO was who did it, right? Because what he saved him from was having to live with that shit. And
yeah, the NCO was a guy by the name of Robert Ward, who was a staff sergeant at the time. He was a good NCO. I mean, he was one of those rock solid career non-commissioned officers that I think are the backbone of the Marine Corps. And he was just a hell of a good man.
You know what? And I would absolutely echo that. And when you see the Marine Corps buckle and doing dumb things, it's because they don't have guys. Marines don't have guys like that around who put an end to that stupidity as it gets going. Because it's part of the barbarity that goes with war, that we have the guns, we make up the rules. Well, when you begin to go sniff down that trail and you want to live by that code, no. You are, you know, the American code of conduct. I'm a soldier in the armed forces of the United States of America, and I'm an American fighting man. And when you get away from that, and it's so easy when you're pissed and you're disillusioned to go down that road, but that's the road to murder. And you don't want to be a murderer because you don't want to have to live with that. And you can get away with it. When you have the guns and you make the rules and nobody else can do anything about it, you can do pretty much whatever the hell you want to, right? So
that's right. And, you know, and a lot of times you would see people do dumb stuff because there wasn't a old Corps Marine there or a officer that didn't have his head up his rectum. No, I mean, it happens. I could see if you had a patrol as a corporal and three lance corporals and a bunch of PFCs and you're all 19 and you're out and you've gotten a firefight, I can see people going over there and urinating on your enemy.
Right.
You know, I can see that.
But
you know, it's all part of that.
So as a Vietnam guy, when you read that it's sergeants and staff sergeants and there's lieutenants in the area, your reaction to that is what?
Well, it's just a failure of leadership.
Right.
I mean, it's a failure. and they're failing their troops. So, you know, you need officers and senior NCOs because they're hopefully enough to, you know, to put you in the right direction. And not always, but generally speaking, I found that that was the case in the Marine Corps.
And it's always been the case, is that right. Steadying hand. And, you know, because oftentimes when the officers talk, you know, what do junior enlisted Marines hear? Wah, wah, wah. But when that staff sergeant walks in and says, all right, listen up, right?
Right.
You get eyeballs and you get ears because that guy, he owns me. He will make my life hell if I want to be an ass. Same thing.
That's right.
And I asked somebody, same thing with hazing. When a staff sergeant that's worth his salt or a sergeant walks in and says, nobody is going to do anything to these Marines, everybody got it? When that guy says that, I asked this guy, does he get defied? And the answer was no, never. Those guys that are worth their salt, when they say that stuff, everybody listens because you know if you defy him, there will be hell to pay. And that's the way it works. So.
Yep. It's the way it works. And, you know, it also, I've had officers or I had a company commander in Vietnam before the siege. It was a Mustang. Won some or was awarded or earned or whatever you do, a number of medals for bravery in Korea and got out and went to college and came back in the Marine Corps. And boy, if that guy told you something, you would do it because of a number of reasons. One of them, you respected him for his experience, but you knew he'd take you out back of the bunker and whoop the shit out of you. He would. He did. He whipped the guy's asses. He gave him shit, man. There were no court martials, no Article 15s. Your ass whipped by Captain Green.
We don't need to go there, right?
Yeah. So it didn't take long. Everybody, when Captain Green told you to do something, you did it.
You know, and those are always, in my opinion, those are the common elements. You'll laugh when I say this, but one of my messages the other night, I had to, you know, you're what makes the Marine Corps special. You looked at all the other services and said, I'll choose this, which means you ain't right in the head, all right, which means you want more, which is what has always made the Marine Corps different and unique. Two, don't be afraid to fight. And with that, you know, everybody looks like, what? And then I played a little audio from the Commandant talking about hazing. People want you to do the wrong thing. Because I said all these different leadership failures, right? If somebody says, the stuff at Parris Island, hey, knock it off, Gunny. Hey, get out of here, McNamara. You know, twerp, you want to fight, Gunny? I'll fight you, but I ain't having this anymore. You can't call that kid a terrorist. You can't make him simulatedly slit somebody's throat for your entertainment. So this ain't happened. You want to fight? Let's fight. Let's go right now. So I'm saying this in the speech. And I said, so people, that don't be afraid to fight them. And I played this audio from the Commandant saying, hey, you want to fight? I'll fight you. You want me to do the wrong thing? I'm not doing it. I know what's right. I know what I'm supposed to do. I ain't having it. So fight. So I played that. And I said, okay, so anybody need? You just heard it from the Commandant. Anybody need any other guidance? Don't be afraid to fight for what's right. I mean, it says that in our song, first to fight for right and freedom. Don't be afraid to fight for what's right, and don't be afraid to fight for the Marine Corps and what's
and
right
to keep
here.
Our honor clean.
Well, and then I even say that. I said, do you think that they knew all the way back then that how important it was to keep your honor clean because you got to live with it? Was somebody that smart, or did they just throw that stupid line in there? I said, I don't know. Maybe they did, but it's good advice. So, anyway. All right, sir, I've taken too much of your time. Ken Rogers, our guest this morning. Get the documentary. You just heard the start of it. I'll read you this email about the start. I was sitting here at my desk listening to the start of that, and it gave me chills just the way he described it. And for the love of God, he got his arm stepped on. You got to be kidding me. I'll buy it. Mac, I appreciate the people you have on this program. Just today is a great idea of, is a great idea of why I like All Marine Radio. The explanation this morning of what a C2 is and how difficult egressing out of that thing and ditching in the water would be helps us all understand it. You're not going to hear that explanation on too many radio programs or TV programs today. And then having guys like Ken Rogers come on to talk about the Burns documentary and then just life as a Marine as he knew it, leadership and documentary filmmaking. Very, very cool interview. Thank you for doing that. So I don't know that I could say it better than that there, Roger. So thank you very much for doing this and happy Thanksgiving.
And same to you, and thanks for listening to me.
Oh, no. Let me tell you, you are the voice of wisdom, my friend. I mean, I'm exactly. That ought to scare the crap out of a lot of people. But, no, I mean, you've gone down the path that a lot of people are going down right now, and now you're a documentary filmmaker, which makes you some kind of like celebrity kind of guy. So
Yeah, right.
All on your wife's suggestion. Hey, it wouldn't be.
Yes.
Probably it'd be a good idea if we recorded some of this stuff, huh?
Yeah.
How about that? Do you ever look back and chuckle when you think of that conversation that just that conversation and that idea has led to all these different things in your life?
Oh yeah, it's because at the time, she was saying all this stuff, and I was like, "Well, yeah, okay, sure, right," and I had no intention of any of that really happening because I didn't think it was possible. So I think about that a lot, and how it was just she kept pushing me to make this happen, and she did.
A life-changing experience.
Yeah, very much so.
Wow. All right, then there's hope for the rest of us.
Yes, sir.
All right.
You know what? I've been through hell in my life more than once, and you just get your nose pointed in the right direction, and it's like my friend Michael O'Hara says, put one foot in front of the other.
And don't quit.
Exactly what you do.
And don't commit suicide. Just do it.
That's right. Don't do that. Because you don't know what you're leaving behind. You commit suicide, what you leave behind to the people who love you is devastating, and they'll never get over it.
So keep putting one foot in front of the other and go fight for the help that you deserve from the VA. Don't take no for an answer, right? Talk to other people that are doing it. They'll point you probably in the direction of better people so that you don't have to discover on your own. If you're in a decent-sized city, go to the Marine Corps detachment and ask those son of a bitches for who are the better people at the VA, and they will certainly tell you, and they'll probably buy you a beer. So
the last thing I would add to that is find something in your life that is bigger than you are and pursue it.
You know what? I think that's the other thing that I've learned in this year and a half is that, Marines tend to be purpose-driven people. Doing it for money doesn't make a lot of sense to them because there's an emptiness that – they look for bigger things. So just making money is not what makes them happy. It's kind of interesting, kind of an odd group of ducks. But if you can find that purpose, whether it's making documentaries or All Marine Radio or whatever it is, the guy who was explaining aviation stuff this morning is a guy named Joey Perazzo. And he founded an organization called Warrior Passion. And what they do is they do adrenaline junkie stuff with guys with post-traumatic stress as a way of kind of jump-starting them back into the human race and getting them out of their doldrums and saying, hey, there's a better world out there. Come on, let's go do something crazy and have a good time, and let's get life moving again. And so there's all these very cool stories out there. So, and yours is one of them, man. Yours is a huge one. Betty Rogers.
That's her. That's Betty Rogers. She's awesome.
That's awesome. That's awesome. All right,
and
sir.
She loves Marines. So, God bless her.
You know what? I I interviewed a Gold Star wife yesterday, and I said, often, you know, when you meet Marines, you know, Marines are Marines, right? But what's really interesting are the women that find them attractive. I said, now that's interesting. So, like, we are our own little crazy subset of the planet, right? But
right.
You're attracted to us. So that makes you a little bit of a different duck as well.
That's right. Exactly right.
And then they initially go through the process of trying to deny it, and then at some point they cave in. No, you're right.
Right.
I do like
right.
a little bit of the character in him. I said, "Oh, is that what we're calling it today, character?" She said, "Yes." I said, "All right, all right, sir. Happy Thanksgiving."
And same to you. And thank you so much.
No,
bye-bye.
Thank you. That's a little bit of gold right there, especially that thing about don't commit suicide and mental health. Rogers is awesome. And just to think, again, his whole life changed on the suggestion of his wife. Hey, you know, we really should. That's the best. All right, let me take a break. My sister Susan's supposed to join us. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, you'll meet my youngest sister, Susan. Susan Ann McNamara. Although she has a different last name now. So you'll hear her the day before Thanksgiving.